Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Now, with something completely different to the last hour for you now. So we're going to have a conversation. I think you'll find it fascinating and very enlightening. You might find it a bit challenging too, but in a good way. I'm joined now by the actress Liz Carr. Liz, you're very welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me, Brendan. Thank you. We've got the technical stuff sorted, so I'm here now.
Great. And Liz, you are an actress of renown and Olivier Award winner, but you won't mind me saying that most people probably know you as Clarissa Mullery from the BBC's Silent Witness. But what we're going to talk about today is your new play. So this play is called Unspeakable Conversations, and it's about a debate which really happened between this philosopher called Peter Singer, and then your character is a lawyer and a disability rights activist, Harriet McBride Johnson. So will you tell me first about this guy, Peter Singer, and maybe specifically on his thoughts around disabled babies?
Yeah, so Peter Singer, very much kind of godfather of modern animal rights, and very much lauded. He's still alive. He's an Australian philosopher, and he has some fascinating views, even on things like world poverty and the overpopulation of the world. He's a very clever man. But he believes that that some lives really, if you were not really a person, so like babies, for example, we don't become a person until maybe we're articulate and we have voice. And the same at the other end of the spectrum, and people might have dementia or at the end of their lives. So he says, you know, there are people that maybe it would be better that they were no longer with us, that we killed them. And this particular play, or this particular aspect of his philosophy, is that it's something called, it's basically where he says, a disabled baby is born, and we should be able to end the life of that baby, even until they're sort of two or three, because they're not a proper person. And we know, we imagine, in his view, that they're not going to have a good life purely because they're disabled.
Okay.
And
yeah, for the sake of people...
And that sounds heavy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But it's interesting, and we'll tease it out. For the sake of people who don't know you, Liz, you have skin in the game here. You are disabled and you are a disability activist.
Absolutely. What's really wonderful for me, so yeah, you might know me as Clarissa and Silent Witness, but I'm also quite the disabled activist, the disability rights activist, have been way beyond I was ever on TV. And I'm a disabled woman. If you saw me, I use a wheelchair and I'm quite frail looking. So, you know, if I'd have been born disabled, then I'm the kind of person that he's talking about. He imagines that the future life of somebody like me would mean that it would be better to end my life sooner. And actually even to give my parents a chance of having what he calls a normal baby, a healthy baby, then that's...
Oh, so
that's
that you would have been replaced by a better model, essentially.
That's absolutely the replacement baby theory he has. So, okay. You know, we replace one with the other, absolutely, so, like a car.
So is the core of Singer's argument, and we'll come back to Harriet McBride Johnson then, who decided to engage with Singer, but is the core of Singer's argument that kind of life as a disabled person is not worth living?
He cannot imagine that there can be happiness. And even when she's saying to him, but I'm happy, but my quality of life is far beyond what you imagine, he's kind of like, well, I know you say that, but I don't really believe you. That's because you've not experienced what it's like to be non-disabled. That's because you don't really know. So you're happy despite being disabled, but you're not truly happy. So absolutely, you know, they go at it hammer and tong in different ways through the play and through history they've done this. But I don't think he's changed now. If I was to meet him and say, you know, do you still believe in this? He still absolutely believes in this theory.
And look, we can all be shocked by that, but I think you kind of think that a version of this thinking does permeate into polite society as well, that disability is a tragedy, a terrible life, that you might be better off dead.
I do think that, yeah. I mean, it's not a nice thing to think when you're the person that others might think that about as well, you and your friends and whatever. But I do think our lack of information, our misinformation, the lack of seeing realistic portrayals of disabled people mean that we're afraid, we're ignorant, all of us, misinformed about what it really means to be disabled. So we just assume it must be the worst kind of a lifestyle imagining. And that absolutely there's this strong belief that permeates all of our cultures, I think, that it is better to be dead than disabled. And I've had that come up to me. People who are visibly disabled will often anecdotally talk about even strangers on the street coming up to you and saying, gosh, you know, I think you're amazing. But honestly, if I was like you, I don't think I'd go on. I'd rather be dead. And people aren't being mean. They truly mean that. They're meaning it as a compliment, actually. Gosh, you know, you're doing incredibly, but honestly, you know, I do think it's not meant with malice.
So you're so brave, is it?
Yes. I mean, I am, Brendan. Let's say that. I'm teasing. Yeah. But it is that. Always. Yeah. It is that. Yeah. Or inspirational.
Yes.
Incredibly inspirational because I managed to get up in the morning and on a Sunday and take a phone call with you. You know, I'm incredibly brave.
And to be pitied, Liz. To be pitied, but inspirational.
Thank you. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And I think there's an awful lot of there, but for the grace of God. Like, I don't have to, you know, you deal with that and you do it, because I tell you, if I was in your state,
yeah,
I couldn't do it. And, you know, I'm also not surprised.
Do people not like to even look at you or have you around sometimes? That there, but for the grace of God. Does it make them uncomfortable sometimes, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. That, I mean, you really got it. I mean, these are, you know, really difficult things to talk about. But I think, you know, I think for a long time, that's why we haven't even been on TV. Because who wants to see those different looking bodies and those different depressing lives that we'd rather not think about? I talk sometimes about how I'm two things. Because I'm on TV, if you know me from TV, then I've got a profile. But if you don't know me and you just see me in the street, then I'm just this little disabled woman who can easily be ignored. And there was a classic for me that just sums it up is... So taxis in London, I live in London, and taxis all have ramps, the black cabs. And I was with my PA, my helper, and she was hailing a cab on the street. Now, I hid because they don't like stopping for wheelchairs because they've got to get out and get the ramp. So tactically, I will hide. She'll flag a taxi. And then when he's stopped or she, I will come out and away we go. Anyway, this particular taxi that she'd flagged down, he was like, oh, sorry, you know, wasn't even raining. He just didn't want to get the ramp out at all because he's just doing it for a disabled person. Anyway, then I decide to appear hidden from behind a shop.
Ambushing him,
and come
yeah.
out. Ambushing him, absolutely. And he recognizes me and he's like, yeah, but for you, I'll do anything. And out he skips and he gets the ramp because he recognizes me from telly.
Okay, You have your own complex intersectionalities, we might call it there, don't you?
Goodness.
It's a
yes,
fairly unique one, yeah. Right. Listen, yeah. This brings us to assisted suicide, right? So you made a documentary about this for the BBC recently. It was called, actually, Better Off Dead, right?
Yeah, with a question mark.
Yes. Yeah. Pardon. Not a statement, not an exclamation
not a statement,
mark. Yes.
Yes.
There's a sense in Johnson's own account of the debate, and I presume it's in the... I've read her New York Times, so I obviously haven't seen the play, obviously, that the likes of Singer are offering assisted suicide almost as a favour to disabled people and to people like you, and that the solution to your problem is, well, we'll help you kill yourself.
Yes. It's compassionate. It's humane and compassionate, and we don't want people to suffer, so therefore we offer this. It's touted as progressive, which is like, oh my goodness, assisting people and getting the medical profession. Let's remember what this is. Assisted suicide usually involves, it's another person, and when it's legally done, you know, countries vote on it. And when that happens, it's about the medical profession assisting certain people to do it. So it's like changing the world, changing many belief systems that we have, but to do it in the name of compassion is sort of worse. It's worse because it's killing with kindness, literally. It's sort of saying everything is so bad for you. It must be so bad. We are going to do the right thing. And we are going to do the right thing as a society for people like you. And a great friend of mine said, you know, one of the problems is we can make life for certain groups of people really difficult, really hard to get the support that different people need, that, for example, that disabled or ill or dying people need. We can make it so difficult that if they choose to end their lives, maybe it's not really a choice. Because we haven't done all, we've created the suffering that we're then offering to remove. And I think that's a part of this big debate that we need to have. I think it's overly simplistic to say this is the right thing to do and we should be offering it for this group of people. No, we should be discussing what it really means and what underpins all these belief systems.
It's complicated too. It's more complicated than that in a way, because you talk in the documentary, as you point out, you weren't born disabled, which I think a lot of able people forget, that a huge amount of people, it's not them and us. We all could become disabled at some stage. Yeah. But you do talk about your own struggles with accepting your disability when it came. And there was a time, I think, wasn't there, when you might have thought you wanted to die.
Oh, absolutely. I was so miserable growing up. I was a non-disabled child. Then I became disabled and it destroyed my life, or it destroyed what I believe, my regular, just a kid, having a lovely light time of childhood. And then wham, health problems, difficulties, being teased, didn't see a future because what I was being told, and I wasn't seeing people like me on TV, remember. So I'm seeing no future. I didn't think I had a future. I mean, when I think about this, I mean, I'm trying not to sound all inspirational, all that, because I'm not at all. But when I think about my life now, there is no way as a teen that I had any sense that the life that I now have was possible. And so I understand completely why I wanted to die, in the same way that when somebody becomes disabled and the person that they were is changed and is different and their choices have been limited. I absolutely understand why people would want that as an option. I think we should look at widening those choices and why it is.
Do the medical profession play a part in what you say there about you not seeing any future for yourself and everything? Is the narrative that the medical profession can tend to have around disability also one that doesn't offer a picture of a future?
So, yeah, that's a really great point, because I was really told that I would have a life if I could walk and if I could do everything like everybody else. So my arms, my strength's limited, my mobility's limited. You know, I don't know any kind of cure medically or spiritually that could actually make me normal, in inverted commas, right, and do things like everybody else. However, that was still touted to me as the only way ahead. So I'm growing up, I'm doing, you know, physio, I'm doing everything the medics are telling me to do, but I'm also being told that not using a wheelchair is the way ahead. Mm. Now, actually, as soon as I found being in a wheelchair as an okay thing and not, you know, living death, but actually just a mode of transport to get from A to B, well, life changed. When I started to realize that there were different ways of living and that I could exist and have a good life, even though I wasn't cured or medically, you could tick everything off as being like everybody else's. So yes, there was such a push from everybody around me that there was only one way to have a good life and be better and be healed, in inverted commas. And that made for a very difficult time and a very depressing time. And I was shocked when I visited my mum on the Wirral to do with the documentary. And she told me that even as early as 12, I wanted to not live. I wanted to die.
You see, I'd say people might think that I'm being a bit insensitive in asking you about all this. And like Harriet McBride-Johnson, she, in real life, agonised about getting involved in the debate with Singer, because I think she said she felt, am I putting disabled lives up for debate? Is this upsetting for you, talking like this and engaging with the ideas like Singer's and everything?
I mean, firstly, I love the conversation we're having. I loved having it with your researcher. I love it with you, because if we don't talk about these things, then it's all the worse. You know, you said some really interesting things, and it's like, that's what we need to do. It doesn't mean it's easy. And in the documentary, I do. It's actually just a year ago now when I went up and interviewed my mum. And my mum, in her diaries from years ago, her five-year diaries, she put little comments about what was happening for me and what had happened to me, of course. And for the documentary, she had gathered all of these, and she read them out. And to hear about being bullied and about being unwell and about not wanting to live, I mean, hearing that, even if that's in the name of making a TV program, mm-hmm. you know, I kind of knew what I was doing, but I don't think I knew how difficult that was going to be. And it is hard. There was a day last week, actually, and spoiler alert, I'm really sorry, but this isn't part of the play, but Harriet McBride Johnson died at the beginning of the 2000s in 2008. As I say, it's not a plot point. It's not, you know. Mm. However, the eulogy was read out, and it was really hard hearing that. It was because there are a lot of similarities between me and Harriet, both because we're disabled women and we interest in campaign and the same issues. But to hear our lives described in that way, and to feel that we actually need to fight for recognition, not just individually, but for our world and our community and other disabled people, is hard. And hearing how people do view you can be really difficult. Yes, but you then
she go. Also, didn't she say she got tired of having to be around educating everybody on a one-by-one basis about disability?
Yes, I do feel that a lot of the time, but I don't know how to not do that. Don't know, it's just become a way of life, and you know that because we mightn't know disabled people, we mightn't have contact. So you know that you're there in the role of educator, whether you want to be or not, and you can take that on. You don't need to. We shouldn't have to. But again, if we're not out and about, things are inaccessible, we're not on TV, you don't see us, out of sight, out of mind, then I do feel the responsibility to speak up. And because I feel like I have a relatively strong profile, I also feel I need to use that to do something. I think that's different. I don't think anyone should feel that or has to feel that. I don't think I'd be me if I didn't do that.
Yeah, well, may I say that's very brave and inspirational of you to have that. So, Camir, you've mentioned a few times visibility. You couldn't see anyone like living your future when you were a kid and everything. Has that changed much? Like, have things changed much even since the debate happened 20 years ago, I think?
Yeah. It is interesting. It's like, you know, the more I talk about the play and now and how our lives are. So I'm doing the play with Matt Fraser, another disabled actor, and he's playing Singer. But we also play ourselves in the play. And the way to do that, the reason we're doing it, is so that we can comment as well and bring some humour, hopefully. I mean, Harriet's very funny, but it's a very particular Southern Belle kind of lawyer humour. And we'll be bringing different kind of quite bawdy sometimes humour. But we also reflect on, this was 20 years ago, and really nothing's changed. We're having the same conversations. Yeah. If anything, I feel that the conversations are changing from being things about discussing rights, and instead it's about survival. I do feel like that. I feel it's a lot more basic and about our right to exist. That argument has always been there, but I feel that as more countries discuss and try and legalize assisted suicide, and as these ideas get about and don't get discussed openly with disabled people as part of the discussions, then I think it feels a little more frightening than it did. Actually, yeah.
Yeah, and you see, we probably don't realise that a lot of these threads and attitudes are there buried in. It's like, so we had a referendum here recently, and one of the questions was around care, right?
Yeah.
So there was this very well-meaning conversation around carers, right? And, you know, everyone agreeing that they're terrific and all that kind of thing. But one of the things that kind of blindsided everybody was disabled people coming out then and saying, hang on a minute, we're being portrayed here as some kind of burden. Like, I don't think people even realise they were doing it. Do we subconsciously still tend to see disabled people as the burden, yeah?
I think we do. I think we see it as a problem, a cost, extra time. And therefore not, well, you know, there could be a cost benefit to that. Well, at least we put all that into those people, but then they may not be able to work. They may not be, we may not see them as well as people who can work or people who might be suitable as partners. The negativity around us is so great that we are not seen often as contributors. We're seen as takers and not giving anything back in return. Now, if you have disabled people in your lives, you'll know that that's a lie, because it's also about what's give and take. And my partner, who's not disabled, you know, when we first got together, I was told things like, you know, well, you're punching above your weight, and things like that. And she was seen as being the person taking on the burden from disabled person.
She was seen as a very good person, was she?
Of course, she is.
What a good person.
She laughs.
Yeah.
And she's like, you've got no idea, because in actual fact, what you see is, she's a high maintenance one, is what I'm saying.
She's a high maintenance one,
you know, and she knows it. So, but perception would be standing next to each other, disabled woman, who is, who is going to be the biggest drain, and it will always be me. And there will not be a perception that we are equal. You know, we're not seen as partners. We're not seen as all of those things. And yeah, people don't realise. It's not often conscious.
Do they see her as effectively a carer?
Oh my. Yes. I mean, often, because she's a little bit butch. That's my description of her, okay? And we have been, that's relevant, because sometimes over the years we've been out and people have thought that she's my son, and they've thought that she's my male carer. I mean, honestly, they never, like, if we're holding hands even, they will not think usually that we're partners. It's hilarious, because honestly, you can get away with murder. I'm not going to say anymore. But people's assumptions, you might as well play with them, because they definitely don't think that she's my partner, lover, wife, whatever. We're not equals, definitely not. She's my carer, or I'm her mother, and she's my doting son looking after me. So, I mean, we laugh at that. Occasionally, I'm like, oh my God, I better get the oil of you lay out, if that's how old I'm looking. But, you know, that's my vanity and ego, that's fine. But yes, perceptions, the last thing people are going to assume is that we are a partnership, an equal partnership. And that's very sad. That's a shame. And all you can do with that is play with that and just do your own thing and live your life. And when you get opportunities to speak out, speak out. But equally, I don't feel I have an obligation to sort of put my life out there. I did it in the documentary more than I have ever done before, because it felt like something so important to me that I would do that. But otherwise, no, I don't need to put my life out there just to go, do you know what, please don't kill me. Please don't kill people like me. But I think that's what Harriet felt she was doing, and I understand why she did it, and I can feel the same. It's an amazing play, Brendan. And I promise you, it is much fun. There is a song and a dance in it. I mean, really. So it's not all about killing babies. That's all.
Yeah.
I'm
okay.
Saying.
Okay. Yeah. In case people, I probably brought all the heaviness to this conversation. I'm sorry.
Yes,
it is a play.
It is
entertaining, and it is funny and everything. And so, do you reenact the debate and then kind of explain, contextualise things in it? Is that how the play works?
We do it in and out. We do it, we mingle from the very first encounter. So they meet at a debate, and then they email. They become kind of email buddies for a long time. And then he invites her to go to Princeton to debate with him. And then she writes about it in the New York Times. And that's where it became a bit infamous, really. And it is an incredible journey and an incredible friendship. And we move in and out at different scenes and different times. So it's not always like in the beginning, this is it, and then this is the end. So it isn't, we're loving making it and being able to, like, in fact, this morning I've had 2 hours on my accent because she's, you know, she's from Charleston, South Carolina. And she's,
go on, let's hear it.
No.
Go on.
You know what? You're going to have to come.
Okay.
You're going to have to get tickets. They're still available. It's
We'll give a good plug at the end with all the
you
details and tickets.
Thank you.
Just before we finish up, can I ask you about show business and television and everything? Has it changed?
Yeah.
Has it changed in terms of representation, visibility, all of that? Would you have been in a mainstream television show 20 years ago just happened to be playing a character?
No, absolutely not. No. And I think we can point to a few more disabled people on TV than we used to.
A few more.
Cultural references used to be like Sandy and Crossroads and Davros on Doctor Who. I mean, there really wasn't an Ironside. And now I know that most of the soaps have disabled characters of different types. And Doctor Who has had disabled characters. I mean, it's just, we're sort of everywhere. Grantchester, Silent Witness, now is a deaf woman in it. I mean, it's like, it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And I think, you know, its time is coming even more and more. And that's the same now in theatre. And that is brilliant. It's still not enough. It's never going to be enough. I'm always going to want more. And I think that's right, because we're trying to get over and put across that actually we're complicated disabled people in the same way that the world is. We come in all shapes and sizes. I don't also speak for all disabled mm-hmm. people at all. Not all will agree with me on this subject or these subjects, assisted suicide or otherwise, and absolutely I respect that. So, but that's the thing, we need to hear all of these different views and be prominent. And that's the problem, like the question in the referendum. We probably weren't part of creating those questions. We probably aren't a huge part of government. We probably aren't the lawyers and the drafts people who make these decisions. That's it. Until you're there in those worlds, you're not going to know our worldview. And it's a good worldview and it's an important worldview. And we need to listen to these different views.
So you need to be in the room. You need to be at the table.
Always, really good way of putting it. Yeah, nothing about us without it.
Liz Carr, thank you so much. That was really interesting. Unspeakable Conversations is part of the Galway International Arts Festival. It's running the 14th to the 27th of July, and people can get more information on tickets, etc. at giaf.ie. Liz Carr, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Brendan, thank you. An absolute pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.